All right. I hope you have been enjoying getting to know my friends and fellow co-hosts. It's been awesome to see them get to know one another, from Stoy's obliviousness of white Christian church culture to Amy's sincere fear of Matt, who's no longer a Christian, being eternally condemned, to Matt crushing on Hain and Robbie, or at least admiring their looks. So today you get to hear two of these folks, Hain and Matt Oxley, talk about their faith, deconstruction, all sorts of personal stuff. An episode that also aired on Matt's The Great Deconstruction podcast. You should check it out. Links will be in the show notes. I love these two guys. Initially met Hain a long time ago through his childhood friend, Matt Carter, who I did Bad Christian with. Met Matt when I invited him to my online community years ago. He accepted the invite reluctantly, given his track record with online communities tied to the Christian faith wasn't all that successful. Nothing of his doing, mind you. I mean, who in their right mind could not like Matt Oxley? Want to give a shout out to Hayden Carr, friend of this podcast, got his master's degree. So now as a teacher, he can get paid what he's worth, man. Good Lord, pay the guy. Wanted to share a few messages from listeners. This is why I do this podcast. Hey, Joey, just want to tell you that I found your podcast this morning and I really appreciate it. I found Tiffany Yecky Brooks through another podcast last week and was trying to find some other podcasts that she was on. Found your interview with her. I'm encouraged to hear there are other people in Charleston deconstructing and wrestling with things. Sometimes it feels I'm the only one. I left my church last summer. I was on staff leading the counseling ministry, and I walked away after being a part of that church for 20 years when I started realizing after reading some great books that the things being taught about men and women in ministry were actually not biblical, and the feelings that I've had for the last two decades were in fact valid, in parentheses, my gut being triggered and not my sin nature that needed to learn to submit and confirm more. I feel so unbelievably free in this season, and believe me, it has not been without ups and downs, but at the end of the day, I know without a shadow of a doubt that God has led me to this place, and He is in the wilderness, which is what this season feels like for me. Anyway, I just want to let you know that I was encouraged to hear more about your story. Thank you for your bravery and vulnerability, and I appreciate that. I just finished listening to the Pushing Back Against Universalism episode. As a convinced universalist, I came away with the thought that I need to be careful not to be contemptuous toward people with other views. After reading David Bentley Hart's That All Shall Be Saved for a second time, I leaned towards, how can you be a Christian and not be a universalist? I need to be careful with that attitude if I want to communicate God's infinite love to others that don't share that view. John Alexander. That's wonderful, by the way. He believes in universalism, but learned from the guys pushback who didn't. A gut check not to be arrogant about beliefs of any kind. I love that. I love hearing from you all. Reach out anytime, email, social media, whatever. For all the hate social media gets, it's crazy sometimes. We forget what we have. I mean, you realize in my lifetime, the only way to look up someone was in a gigantic book called a phone book with phone numbers and addresses, street addresses, and some people were unlisted. Those are like today's, I'm not going to be on social media people, I guess. The ones that were unlisted in the phone book, actually, they were just smarter than everybody else. But with social media, you can actually drop someone a note just to say, hey, saw you on here. Great memories with you. Hope all is well. Enjoyed the pics of the family. Most people that I'd send a message like that to, I'd never call on the phone out of the blue. Imagine how awkward that would be, calling somebody 20 years after the last time you saw them, just saying, hey, man, just thought I'd call. Been thinking about you. Okay, well, what else? For someone who really loves people and who is also an introvert, I'm very thankful for social media. I reconnected with an old neighborhood friend when we were best buds back in elementary school, got in bad arguments. He'd always take advantage of my unwillingness to cuss. He knew about my faith and from experience knew how legalistic I was. I'd say something like, you're lying out of your teeth. And he'd say, well, you're lying out of your ass. And he knew I couldn't top him. That's super unfair. Took advantage of my handicap to swear. All right, so quick note before we proceed to Matt and Hayne. On the B-Sides feed, I just uploaded part two of my faith story so far. We've made it up until I was eight, how I ended up at a Pentecostal church, and how I believe I heard clearly from the Lord. We continue on. It's pretty therapeutic for me. All right, enjoy Matt and Hayne. And thank you, Matt, from the Great Deconstruction Podcast, for letting me post this up here on the PWNA mixtape era.
I like demanded, pleaded, called God on promises and was like, you have to show up or like I am done. And he did. And he did.
That's something to really think about. What does it mean that the God of the universe loves me?
Are we saying that our God is bigger than their God or what?
Man, you got my mind going crazy right now.
I just think that that is evangelical bullshit.
And I don't fit in their box anymore. So feeling rejected from the church makes me feel far away from God.
If I'm living out the love of God, love of the divine, then in some ways we're unoffendable.
It's wrong to marginalize anybody for any reason.
Sometimes we can just have some things about our perspective that's off until we encounter someone who can challenge our thoughts, have conversations with us, and we just continue to grow and evolve.
I got him with you there. Yeah, I like that.
That sounded like womp, 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 womp to Rob.
I'm a hardcore gospel lover. I do love the gospel. I just think we get it wrong.
Girl, I was so highly medicated, I don't even know if you
Oh, found my people.
Hey guys, welcome to the Great Deconstruction Podcast. This is going to be known as Season 2. I kind of had to take a hiatus for a while because of a lot of trouble with our internet connection here at my house that kind of persisted through the summer, and it seems to be fixed now. I think we're all better. Today, I have the great pleasure of talking to my good friend Hayne Griffin from Asheville, North Carolina. He is a brilliant, kind, loving man, and I'm honored to know him and to know his story and to see the impact he has on the world that he's part of. Hayne's a great guy. We've known each other for 3 or 4 years now and met through another podcast called Pastor with No Answers. You can go listen to that and hear one or both of us talking pretty often. And Hayne's here telling his story about how he grew up and what he believed and how much that's changed over the last several years. I think you'll get a lot out of it. And I hope you learned something today. Got a lot of cool stuff coming up in the next season. Got 3 or 4 already lined up to record. So look forward to it and get ready for Season 2.
Gotcha. I am joined by Hayne Griffin. Is it Griffin?
Yeah, you got it.
Griffin. Griffith?
Yeah, Griffin. I am.
Okay, yep. I forget.
Yeah.
Okay. We've known each other a couple years, maybe 2020, 2021.
Yeah, right around there.
Through Joey.
Joey Svensson.
Through Joey Svensson, the Joey Svensson of the Pastor With No Answers podcast, which we're both co-host on. And Hayne is a brilliant guy and kind and gentle and very funny. And I enjoy listening to Hayne more than anybody because he'll.
Oh, Matt. Hayne is making me blush now.
No, I'm serious. You will stop and think before you speak, and that is a lost art. You really absorb what people are saying and you listen to them before you respond. And I don't see you, I never see you in your head trying to think of a response.
Oh, wow.
I always see you listening. And that's a wonderful thing. And I can tell that you've got a lot of experience in just listening.
Well, thank you so much. I would say literally the same thing about you. So I really appreciate, you saying that. So thanks, brother.
Well, yeah. So tell everybody who you are. You're like a superhero firefighter, union leader. I just found out.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Tell us about everything that is you today, and then we'll start talking about back in the day.
Sounds great. Yeah. Me today. So I'm in my mid-40s. I have been a professional firefighter. That's what everybody kind of gets drawn to is when they find out that I'm a professional firefighter. They want to talk about that and hear about that. So I've been doing that.
And you've been on the calendars at least once, right?
Yeah, sure. No, okay. I've never been on a calendar.
Really? I thought you had. Oh, shoot.
No, I hadn't been on a calendar. We haven't done one since my tenure there, but there was one done a few years before I was there. Yeah. I mean, it took just such public criticism that they never did another one. But
That sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. But I've worked as a professional firefighter for 15 years. I work for the city of Asheville, North Carolina, which is a really unique city. It's the largest city on our side of the state. So it's around 100,000 people. It's not very big, but because it is the largest city, because the major hospitals are there, and then major businesses like the Biltmore Estate. A lot of people know about the Biltmore House. And then just all the industry that's there.
Yeah, a lot of people go vacation over there.
Tons. So between the tourism and then just so many folks that live outside the city that come into work, the city usually swells and just buzzes around 250,000 people almost all the time. But over half the people that are in it they do not pay taxes. They're not property owners in the city, which is kind of interesting. So, and a lot of people know Asheville because it's this kind of this outdoor hub, and that's what drew us to it. I love the mountains, big climber, love to rock climb, love to hike. My wife's the same, married, have two children. I have a daughter that's 16 and a son that's 14 and they're just super fun, super cool people. I love this stage right now of being a dad. I was not a baby guy. Honestly, I hated being the parent of a baby. It was like having a pet turtle and I didn't like it.
Oh my.
Yeah, it's just something that shits and eats and you just feed it. Yes. And I felt really, really, bad. I felt even some sense, I guess, shame because all my friends at the time were like, oh, I just love you. Parent. I was like, fuck, I don't. Like, this is.
They're just lying.
Yeah. It's this is taking a huge hit on my playtime. It's super selfish to say that, but it's true if I'm being honest. Yeah. But I love this age. Obviously, the kids, they come out of that and they develop their personalities. You begin to love them. And I loved them. I mean, I can say this. I loved them instantly, but I really didn't like them until they got, about a year or 2 years under the.
It sounds to me like whenever a stray dog shows up in my yard.
Right.
This sounds even worse.
Come on, bring it.
But like eventually, like 2 or 3 days in, like it's my fucking dog now.
Right.
So I got to start to find reasons to like it. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like that happens a lot to me.
Yeah, absolutely. So
I appreciate your honesty there because parents don't tell that truth often.
No, I think they're afraid to. And you know me well enough now. I will say whatever, is true for me. So in my experience, because I think there's so many people that feel the same way. Hopefully, if someone's hearing this, they're like, yeah, I really hated being the parent of an infant. It's and just having to deal with my own selfishness and how I just wanted to be in control of to have that responsibility was really a difficult transition for me. The kids now are 14, they're 16, and I know a lot of people hate this time because of the hormones and the teenage years, and I love it. I love the conversations we have. I mean, we're talking about everything from sexuality to politics to what does it mean to just be a good person? What does it mean to be kind rather than right? What does it mean to navigate this world? And Matt, I love it. I get so much laugh out of it. My kids are so cool. And they may have the wool pulled over our eyes. I don't think so. I mean, I know they do teenage bullshit. Yeah. They hide from us. That's normal.
I think this generation is brilliant. I really think that they are heavily underestimated. Yes. And I thought that about the previous generation too, and I still do. But this next one is has gone through hell. Mm-hmm. They're inheriting just the absolute worst version of the earth that we possibly
Agreed.
Could.
Yep.
And somehow their humor is beyond the pale.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the darkest,
my son.
Most disgusting humor. I love it. It's hilarious. They are the funniest people. And somehow can communicate
ideas that are very radical.
Yeah.
I think that this generation has a political leaning that is going to surprise us in a very good way. I posted a meme several years ago about Gen Z taking me off because I'm not socialist enough and shoot me because I'm just not quite commie enough. And I'm as communist as they get because they're just so cool, right. You know.
Yes.
But yeah, anyway, that's so cool. What are your kids like politically? What are their political thoughts like? I'm curious about
that. They're at that age where there's still so much of their ideology is shaped by me and shaped by Erica, my wife. So we have had to become really careful about some of the things that we say because they'll just embody it because they trust us. And I want them to start thinking for themselves. They're beginning to. So just for the listener, where I'm at politically, I'm definitely left of center and very intrigued and drawn towards socialist democracies. You would be more communist than I am, but the current path that we're on is cancerous. It's a slow cancer. Yeah. It's just killing society, and not that we have to get deep into that. So. But our kids hear us say things, and with everything happening politically ramping up, you know, my son made a comment, maybe this was 2 weeks ago, just kind of bashing Trump. And I said, well, why do you think that? Like, where did you hear that? And he said, I heard it at somebody at my school. And I said, would you believe that? And he said, well, yeah, I guess. And I said, well, why do you believe it? And he said, well, I don't know. It just sounded right. And I said, well, hey, I think it'd be good to do some research. You know, just, I'm not a Trump supporter, but if you're going to dog the guy, know why. You know, if you're going to be critical, have some backing. So, so our kids, they're developing that on their own right now, which is kind of cool. They are spiritually, it's just interesting where they're at. I think because where I've evolved and where Erica has evolved, they're definitely people of faith and they're involved in the local church that we really don't go to. They're involved with Young Life. That's a really big kind of parachurch ministry. Yeah. And the school. And honestly, what I love about it is it is surrounding them with some really just good kids. I mean, kids that are at least moral kids, which I appreciate. But what I love about my kids too is they're very liberal socially, very progressive socially, and have good reason why. And I love my daughter. She is just a fireball, and I love her coming back from youth group and telling us, yeah, so and so said something that was really derogatory against the trans community, really derogatory against the gay community, and even said, you know, the Bible says, and she just pushes back. She's like, that's not true. And they're like, well, and then she'll push back on her friends. And I love that about them. So my kids they're wonderful. We spend a lot of time with them. I just think, I mean, this talking about dogs, but you know, I have a firm belief about just pets and animals that great dogs are animals or cats or any animal, any pet in the home is an animal that's had a lot of time spent with it, you know, developing relationship. I'm not trying to liken my children to pets. That's not what I'm saying. But we really put a high, high value on time and spending a lot of time with our kids to the point actually where, and this kind of unpacks a little bit more of just kind of who I am right now. But Eric and I, we live very simply. We live in a very small home. We downsized in 2013, which I'm sure will come out in our conversation later. But we were kind of on this trajectory of just living that normal American life. And experienced some significant suffering in life. And I was like, okay, it was just a hard reset for our minds to say, what do we really value? And one of the biggest things we valued was time and time together. So we downsized considerably. We did the opposite of kind of what a lot of our friends were doing. And we decided, you know what, we're going to live real small so we can travel and experience real big and have big time, have more time together. So that's how we've chosen to live. And I think my kids, where they're at, I mean, again, I could be totally wrong. I could be totally blinded. I don't think so. Mm-hmm. But they're really good kids. They're good people. We're doing the teenage thing right now. I work for the Asheville Fire Department. We have a very robust labor union. North Carolina is a right-to-work state, so that does give us handcuffs us a bit and some of the things that we can get done. But we're very large. 90% of our membership are unionized, and I'm in a leadership role with that. And I love advocating for the little guy. I love advocating for the guys in the trenches, and that's kind of where I'm at.
I mean, me too. I actually tried to unionize multiple workplaces, but it is super anti-union down here.
Oh, I'm sure.
People thought I was crazy.
Yeah.
So, and people, like, the thing is, the management knew, but they were so not worried about it, they never even brought it up. It was just like, whatever. He'll never do it.
So, oh, my gosh.
So,
surprise.
And it didn't happen. So, we just couldn't get it. We couldn't get it to happen. Yeah. There's a lot of propaganda about it.
There is.
And people believe it. My mom, I remember her voting on union at one of her jobs, which would have been life-changing for us, for me. And she voted against.
Oh, man.
It would have changed our lives.
Yeah.
Overnight, probably, because her income would have increased so much. But
absolutely.
The propaganda won.
Yeah. Yeah. So you'll find this interesting, and I think you'll appreciate this story. Similarly, growing up, I grew up in upstate South Carolina in a conservative home, great home, but very conservative. And all the propaganda, like with unions, I had heard all the bullshit. And I'm not saying that any organization's perfect. They're not. But I had heard, all the things, almost demonized, but I've always tried to keep an open mind. When I was hired, I went in to sign my paperwork. This was 2008, I believe. I went and signed my paperwork. And the city gives their whole spiel. Somebody from HR comes in and gives a whole spiel, and they put the papers in front of you and you sign your papers. I was like, okay, you're officially an employee. But then the union came in, two union representatives, just to explain to us the union and everything about it. So they came in, gave an excellent spiel about who they are, what they do. I was a little energized by it. I was like, wow, this sounds really good. There was a guy sitting beside me who was from the area, but he had worked for Washington, D.C. Fire. So he was a DC firefighter for 7 years prior. I was just moving closer to home. And I looked at Aaron and I knew he was experienced. And I just said, because I was curious, was he in the union originally? Because we're a large organization. We're unionized, but we're also part of an international. We have our local. So I looked at Aaron and I said, Aaron, were you in the union in DC? And he looked at me and said, oh, hell yeah. It'd be just like that. And I said, oh, that was a pretty robust, quick answer. I like that. I said, why? And he said, real simple, bro. He said, local government will do everything in their power to fuck you. And the union stands in the gap.
Yep.
And when he said that, I was like, you show me where to sign my name. That sounds great to me.
Yeah. And they're broke. Local governments are so broke right now. Totally. So they can't.
Yep. Yeah, and
that's
what we're dealing with right now.
Falling apart.
Yeah. And we're a very tourism-driven economy, which is good because a lot of people are traveling. But what happened post-COVID here, real estate prices over doubled, and it's just created a huge inequality. This is the fight we're in right now, a huge inequality for particularly our youngest guys. They can't afford to live here. They're all moving an hour and a half out because they can't. The housing costs are too high, and the pay's too meager. So we're really in a robust dialogue and a good dialogue. City council has been wonderful to us to hear us out.
That's good. So,
yeah.
So tell me about your growing up, your experience in life as a kid, the good, the bad, the ugly, whatever you're willing to share, and kind of weave in the religious picture, the tapestry there. Yeah.
Absolutely. Born and raised in a Southern conservative middle class home. So I am your quintessential white Southern male, truly. As far as where I started, I will also say this, and I know a lot of people can't say this. My childhood was not perfect, but one of the adjectives I use for my childhood is at some measure it was very enchanted. And what I mean by that is. Two parents who still deeply love each other. My dad's 77. My mom is 74. They've been married for 40 something years. My mom is currently going through some horrible dementia stuff, and my dad is more committed and more loving to her than he's ever been. It's a marriage that has evolved, a relationship that's evolved. Though we grew up and were raised in a Baptist, Southern Baptist context, my parents, even though they were and are, although my mom's a closet liberal, I tell her that all the time. She's at a place in her mind right now where she just can't, she has a hard time remembering what month of the year it is. But I used to always say, Mom, you're.
Yeah. My mom, by the way, is also dealing with dementia early onset right now.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. It's rough. Yeah,
it is rough.
We don't live close. Yeah. So there's a lot of worry.
Oh, yeah. I totally feel that space. And they live an hour and a half from me. And my wife, which I'm sure is going to come out later as well, you know, the last 3 years has been fighting and battling and doing really well with the battle against breast cancer. But that took so much of our emotional space, time, and energy that my sister's been the one that's really led the charge with helping my mom. But anyway, I tell my mom all the time, even, you know, pre the mental decline, you are a closet liberal. You do, your orthopraxy does not match your orthodoxy at all. So even growing up in that context, I mean, my parents disagreed on a lot of stuff, even on the Bible. My mom took a more progressive stance with it. But I feel like because she grew up in Piedmont of North Carolina, kind of small town North Carolina, there was a certain social way she just kind of had to be because she was raised in the 50s and 60s. So she was this interesting mix. And my dad as well. For example, and I know we had this conversation maybe a year and a half ago, but you know, I grew up in the whole Southern Baptist purity culture. My parents, they never said, you know, that's bullshit, but they never lived that way. And I had this sexual ethic at home that was so different than the sexual ethic I was being preached, you know. Theirs was just,
you know, my mom did too. That's funny. She was very liberal with that. And she was a heathen when I was growing up, really. And she didn't become a Christian until I left the faith.
Oh, wow.
But I grew up, she was, you know, kind of slutty and doing stuff that I wouldn't have done. God, I got to cut this out in case. Shit. I have to cut that out.
You're good.
Crap. Yes. So she was just partying and stuff like that. Stuff that I would have never done and still won't do because I'm just not into
it. Right. Such a thing.
Yeah, we're just kind of opposites in that way, but she did give me a very liberal view of sexuality that I had a hard time swallowing. It was like, no, you're wrong.
Yeah.
You know, virgin for life if I have to be. Yeah. So, that's interesting anyway. Sorry.
No, you're good. You're absolutely, I love that. And for my parents, they were still very conservative, particularly my father. It still is, but he was always about context. And even though he would have a conservative bent, nothing to him was really ever black and white. Like, the stove and oven, that's black and white. Traffic lights, that's black and white. But when we get into issues of politics, sexuality, religion, spiritual, all those things, he goes, those are just gray areas, and we just have to be honest about that. And I loved that. Yeah. It was so cool to grow up in that home with that, even though on Sundays and Wednesday nights, I was getting, you know, fed one thing, but I just had a home life and parents that spent a lot of time with us, camping, traveling, it was just normal to sit at the table and have dinner together and play cards and just shoot the shit. That's what I mean by enchanted. It was enchanted. And because they were just so emotionally and physically available to us and loved us. My sister, I have a sister that's younger than I am, so well.
Yeah.
So that was my childhood. I was never pressured at all growing up to go to church. It was Sundays weren't optional because I was a little kid and they couldn't leave me at home alone.
Right.
My sister wanted to go on Wednesday nights. I didn't. And they were fine with that. So a parent would stay home. One would take my sister to church. Never any pressure ever to make a decision. I never felt like religion, that they ever forced it down my throat. When I was a teenager, I developed a relationship, a good friendship with a buddy. We kind of started a garage band together. Philip was a very outspoken Pentecostal Christian and a hell of a drummer.
Oh.
A hell of a drummer. And okay. All I knew was this guy plays drums, and I just love being in a band with him. He can wail. And just through that relationship, he kind of got me interested in things of faith. I was 16 years old, and that's kind of when I decided I was going to make a profession of faith, and did. I was very impressionable. Like anything that I heard that had any type of Jesus label, sticker, and I was immediately in. And then, though I grew up in a Baptist context, when I went on to college, I went to a small Baptist school, actually, in Alabama. Sanford University, go Bulldogs. They were in March Madness this year.
I know, yeah. Sanford. I think I have some friends that graduated from there.
Yeah, it was a great place.
I've seen the Bulldog on some shirts around here.
Yeah, the school's kind of growing. It's growing quite a bit now. But I was just really fortunate. I got a significant scholarship to go down there, and went down there. Almost transferred out because it was a little too deep south for me, you know, even growing up in South Carolina, which is definitely southern. It was a deep south to me that Christianity was so ingrained into the fabric of everyone. And I don't like bullshit. I don't like anything that's disgenuine. I remember just struggling. It was at the school. It was, you know, the Greek system was huge. And I learned really early on that when the sorority showed up on Sundays for lunch in the cafeteria, they were all expected to dress like they had gone to church, whether they did or didn't. It was the air of that. And that was for a young 18-year-old kid that was just hell-bent on Jesus and hell-bent on things being authentic and real. It just kind of sent me over the edge. But I had such great relationships and good friendships there. I just remained, and I did all 4 years there and graduated. While I was there, I got exposed to Calvinism and got involved in a Presbyterian Church of America, PCA church.
Oof. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Geesh, guy.
Oh, man. I told you I got deep. I mean, I got deep, Matt.
So I've had a few debates with PCAs. Boy, they are.
Congratulations.
So, I mean... Yeah. You want to talk about jerks.
Brutal.
People that can be brutal. Yeah. Funny.
Oh, yeah. Brutal. Hilarious.
Yes. I've got a bunch of them on my Facebook that I'll occasionally fuck around with.
Oh, yeah.
But you really don't want to tangle up with them because they're good. They're very good.
They're good at arguing. They have very definitive points. And they believe so zealously and fervently in that.
Well, they have no other choice.
Exactly. I mean, it's such a mind job, if we're being honest.
I got really into understanding the Vantillian thing, which is a big part of what the PCA kind of uses as their defense now. They are, it is the most contradictory, self-referential thing I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And you cannot show it to them.
Right. Yeah.
Because then you're doing the same thing. It's just impossible.
Yep.
So it's a very convenient argument because it is impossible to do anything with other than just say it's ludicrous.
It is. And that faith and theology, that group marries itself perfectly into the culture of middle, upper class white males.
Yes, absolutely.
Who believe down. I mean, you grew up in a place of extreme privilege. So when you get when you hear a theology like that, it's like, hell yeah, that completely mirrors how I have grown up my entire life. That must be true. That has to be true.
Yeah.
And it's why you see very few people, minorities in those churches. Just very, very few. And those churches are very
elect.
Only the elect. And if your entire experience of the world has been, you were literally culturally elect by the previous system, by how things have historically played out, particularly in this country, and of course that theology makes great sense. So
yeah, and it's the thing is, it's a very small, it's not a
very
huge
small
group. So but they have an incredible amount of political influence.
They do
nationally and
the communities they're in. They're very influential people and a lot of money.
For me, it's a cult.
And the Christian nationalism.
Oh, boy.
A lot. You can find some roots in there, yeah. I can assure you of that.
You sure can. You sure can. Yeah. So it's it is, for me, and I know if anyone is PCA or is at least listening to this or is connected in some of that, this may offend you, offend them. I don't want to offend you, but it just feels very cultish to me. So I kind of took a deep dive into that. And towards my senior year, I became kind of suspect of it. And a lot of that was because of my father. Even though my dad is definitely an errant infallibility guy, very conservative in how he interacts with the scriptures, he really pushed back. I remember, you're going to laugh at this, coming home like for Christmas holiday, maybe I was a sophomore, and I told him, by the way, I also need to throw this out there about my father. My father is a New Testament theologian, like has a doctorate. He's deeply versed in the scriptures. I came home, I announced to him, I literally walked in the door with my PCA chip on my shoulder and my, you know, Calvinist, you know, thinking. And we were just out in the yard doing some work. I grew up on a farm. I did a lot of stuff outdoors. And I just said, hey, I finally understand election. I get it. And my dad was like, really? And I said, yeah. And he said, let's go inside real quick. So we go inside. He pulls out a legal pad, sits at the kitchen table, pulls out a pen and goes, start talking, because I don't get it at all.
Oh, I love your dad. Okay. And, that's wonderful.
He's a beautiful man. He's an amazing man. And in that moment, I was like, oh, my Lord.
What a perfect way to tell a child that something so profound.
So profound. And it was just one of those immediate moments of, oh, whoa. Like this man who I deeply respect, who knows way more than any of these college seniors and recent college graduates that are feeding me all these lines.
Yeah.
It was just a beautiful way, and it wasn't passive aggressive. It was just beautiful to
you describe it as a genuine thing.
It was. And there were so many things that I could just do a whole podcast on my dad's parenting skills.
That sounds amazing.
He's a cool guy. So anyway, I think that was the beginning of that, that container. I talk a lot about spiritual containers, in my life, and that container that was kind of built, that was very short lived. My dad was the first to take a little hammer and go pink, and it cracked.
Yeah.
And that crack grew really quick, to the point that by my senior year, I just wasn't really involved anymore. I kind of pulled out. I wasn't by any stretch. I just wasn't Calvinist anymore. I by no means was walking away from faith at all, but, yeah, I was like, okay, this is a flavor of Christianity that I just think silly and damaging. So I started to walk away from it.
Yeah.
Took a job out of there and not in retail, but in manufacturing. I worked for an outdoor manufacturer. They manufactured outdoor clothing. Spent a year on the road, basically just selling outdoor gear. Because of my background and just outdoor adventure, I got a job with these guys. That was 2001, and that's right when 9/11 happened. And the economy definitely took a hit, but that entire niche, retail world of outdoor, these are, you know, this is a hobby. It's just a hobbyist niche. It tanked. Everybody was so concerned about the economy.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, if you weren't selling Columbia, North Face, Patagonia, you weren't going to make it. So I wasn't making any money. I was on the road all the time. I was getting pretty lonely. And came out of that, had some buddies that lived in Atlanta, Georgia, in Gwinnett County, which is just north of the city. And they were Young Life Guys, which is a parachurch organization that works with high school students. And they offered me a job to go and stay out with Young Life. So I just needed something different. I was like, yeah, I'll do it. I moved to Atlanta for 2 years and did the Young Life thing. And that was really important in terms of my spiritual development, because the Young Life director was this person that embraced the person of Jesus, embraced what he would say were certain tenets of the faith, but everything else to him was gray. It was, I don't know. And I really appreciate, maybe, I don't know if he would say this about himself, but I would say maybe the first Christian agnostic I'd ever met, you know, someone that was just willing to say, I do not know about all of these things, and that's okay, and I don't need to know. And so he was a real mentor. I was also connected to a local church, and there was some abusive things in the church going on. Very, very subtle, but enough that I felt like I can't do this ministry thing. This is not my jam. And pulled out of that. I took a job building houses for a year, which is probably the greatest education I ever got, Matt.
Yeah, I bet.
Just swinging it.
I can imagine. Yeah. I feel very useless when it comes to like, I own a home and I can't fix shit around here. It's awful.
I got to come down there.
I can't do anything.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm horrible at it.
I need to come down there.
We've got a leaky window, a leaky roof. It's it's not for me. Homeownership was a bad idea for me because I can't.
Sure.
The idea of cutting wood and making it fit in the right place on a just blows my mind.
Right.
And that is a beyond skill to me.
Yeah.
And I'm in awe of construction.
Man, it was such an amazing education for me. And it was bigger. I think it was the first time in my life where I really started to rub shoulders. I had rubbed shoulders before with people. I grew up in the rural South. Was around a lot of and had a lot of Black friends in high school, but I was still blinded somewhat to just their experience and who they were.
Yeah.
And then when I went to college, I was just in this university that was full of just a bunch of middle class, upper class white kids. But then did the Young Life thing in literally middle upper class Atlanta, suburban Atlanta. And then I took this job where I was swinging a hammer. So I was a Spanish minor in college. So I spoke Spanish, and that's what helped me get the building job. And then all of a sudden, I'm spending the majority of my day with legal and illegal workers from Mexico, Guatemala, all these amazing places. I could speak their language, and I was beginning to understand their lives. And it was just a new door started opening up to me. It's like, oh, wait a minute. There's a world out there that's very different. People's experiences are very different. And I was just blown away, too, at their incredible skill. Just like you said, it's like these guys had unbelievable skills that they taught me. I think they were super appreciative that I wanted to speak their language. They loved that. So they began to trust me, and they were teaching me a lot of great things about building. So one of the most formative years for me, just in terms of professionally, and I've had a lot of great professional years, but that was one that was real significant. And as I left that world in terms of that being my sole job, and I went into the fire service, I still use those skills all the time, moonlighting on the side.
Yeah, and, I bet, yeah.
Yeah, and those have been wonderful ways to make side income and just to keep my house dry and keep things, tip-top, which has been nice. So, I did that.
Oh, I'm so jealous of that. That's amazing.
Yeah. So,
I did some roofing and I helped, my dad was a painter. I helped him do stuff, but none of it stuck at all. None of it, but if you put me in front of a computer,
you got
I
would it.
Pick up anything and I could take apart electronics. I love that. But
see,
I don't know if it's wood that I hate or if it's, I don't know.
The way that you feel about, wood, woodworking, that whole world is the exact way I feel inside when I think about computer parts or, it is just a world that I do not like. I think you made a post recently. Yeah. I saw of a PlayStation you completely rebuilt, and I'm looking at that amazed, Matt. I mean, I'm just
that's super easy.
To me, I'm looking at
so easy. Matt,
I'm just so impressed. I'm like, holy smokes! I would just throw the thing in the trash. I would have no idea what to do. So I can I totally feel that space, just in a different context.
Yeah.
So I did that. And then my wife and I, we wanted to get out of the Atlanta area. Everything just felt too fast. And I know you understand the hot and humidity for us. Even my wife's from Minnesota, which is pretty hot and humid in its own ways. But And we just spent a lot of time in the mountains. I grew up right at the base of the Alps in upstate South Carolina. We were always in the mountains, or foothills, always in the mountains playing. And we said, hey, let's just get close to Asheville. So that would have been 19 years ago now. We came into Western North Carolina, petered around for a bit, and then ultimately landed in a little town just east of Asheville called Black Mountain, which now the town's become pretty bougie. It wasn't when we got here. It was still just kind of a little secret little mountain town full of just a lot of local people. But what COVID did to the world, particularly just the exposure we got, there were so many people from the East Coast that nobody was getting on planes, but they would get in a car and drive. And a couple of articles were written about the town in Southern Living Magazine and Travel and Leisure. And then we just had this huge influx, which has changed the landscape. And that's been good and bad. Oh. Any type of growth has its positives and its negatives, but that's where we are. And we're here and we love it. And our kids, this is their community. They're true Black Mountaineers, born and raised here. And it's interesting, even for them, and I love this about their experience, you know, they go to school with a huge variety of people, from, you know, rich white people to very poor Appalachian mountain white people, which is a very different, you know, people. And then we have a significantly large Hispanic community, which I love, also in our school district. So, you know, our kids play soccer with other players that their native, you know, language is Spanish. And I love that our kids are around a lot of native Spanish speakers, and they play sports and do school with, you know, with that. And I think that's really great. So that's kind of got us to, that's what got us to North Carolina. Man, I'm trying to wrap this up real quick and we can kind of get some more meat and potatoes of spirituality. But got here. Bumbled around. We had a surprise pregnancy, which is our daughter. I was doing some construction work, and I was doing a little bit of media work. I can't build computers, but I was able to. I was doing a lot of like video and film work, making ends meet. We had this surprise pregnancy. My wife was a school teacher, and the question was, well, we had this beautiful baby coming. We're excited, but we got to figure some things out financially, because my job was kind of feast or famine. And she wanted the ability to be home at least those first formative years with the baby. So I literally went to a real estate meeting, kind of a under the table, just a group of guys, kind of real estate investors that just kind of look for depressed properties to purchase and fix them up. Because of my skill set, I thought I could kind of do that, and had a little bit of money to invest. And I went to this meeting, bumped into an old buddy from an old church that I had gone to. And we started talking, and he's asking about Erica, and I talked about the pregnancy, and he's like, dude, you ever thought of becoming a firefighter? And I was like, yeah, when I was like 6 years old, I thought that'd be kind of a cool thing to do. And he said, man, you got to look into it. So I came home from the meeting, and I told Erica, I bumped into Wayne, and, oh, how's he doing? Great, great. And she said, well, did you find any properties? I said, no, but I think I'm going to apply to the Asheville Fire Department. And she just burst. She just burst out laughing. She was like, what are you talking about? And to her, it was, you know, that's what all the little, that's what, you know, military, police, fire, you know, it's, are you resorting back to this weird childhood thing right now because you feel pressured, you know? But got into it and went through an entire academy and came out of the academy. And when we were being kind of commissioned into the department, the chief of the department got up and he said one thing I'll never forget. He started the whole thing about, you are now entering into a career where your job is to enter into the worst day of someone's life and make a difference.
Wow.
And when he said that, wow, I thought, I'm all in. Like, I'm all in.
That's amazing. Yeah, wow. Yeah.
I was going to do this just to make ends meet for a few years and figure some other stuff out. And I think I'm going to stick through it. And that was 15 years ago.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's cool. I would have burst out crying if he would have said that to me, because it made me well up.
Yeah. It made,
I'm a softy.
Yeah. Same. I mean, I remember my heart just swelled when he said that. So,
yeah. Yeah, that's an immense responsibility and an honor as well, in such a way, to be that first line of defense. Absolutely. For someone, for their life.
Yeah. And being a follower of Jesus, it just felt really real. I just, coming out of a ministry where it was like, man, just get people to believe the right thing, which I was becoming suspect of a little bit. And then getting in the fire service, and it was like, do the right thing. It's like, oh.
Yeah.
You know, I like that. And then, you know, this will probably launch into where we're heading, but getting into the fire service and then being exposed to so much suffering so quickly was a huge jolt for me that took me on a very different journey. So that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah. So that is a career I absolutely could not handle. Hmm. I'm certain of. I don't do well with gore. I don't do well with anything extreme like you've probably seen. I can't imagine. Sure. And I don't want to, you know.
Right.
It's just a... I can't believe people can do that for a living.
Hmm. Hmm.
And I can't believe... It's just incredible. It's hard to even define to me. And some of the friends I have here locally are EMS guys. So a very similar feeling.
Oh, yeah. You
know, they're going into the very worst moment of someone's life.
For sure.
And staying calm, mm-hmm, and being supportive and just doing so much ministry.
Yes, precisely.
That it, and don't even realize it probably that it is such a mm-hmm ministry to be that person, mm-hmm, just to be a calm presence, yes, that knows more than anybody else in the room for a moment is an amazing, yes, gift to, yes, people.
Well, thank you for saying that. And, you know, we all have our different gifts, you know, the things that we can experience and hold and stomach, things that we can't. We're all in different places. And I think that's just the beauty of humanity and the beauty of community is that we're all bringing things to the table. So thank you for being grateful for ours. So it means a lot.
Yeah. So what is your, I know you mentioned in a text, not just a few minutes ago, mm-hmm, before we got on here, you said something about agnostic.
Yeah.
What did you say?
My evolving agnosticism.
Slide into agnostic.
Okay. My evolving agnosticism. Yeah,
so I have a friend who wrote a piece several years ago about Christian agnosticism.
Mm.
That one was incredibly well done. But I was not familiar with the concept. It hit me in a way that I just, my mind couldn't handle it.
Interesting.
But today, I feel very much in line with that.
Mm,
very much.
Interesting.
But I'm more in the Christian atheist thing because I just lack the belief, yes, and the knowledge. So I'm kind of both. And you mentioned that. So I'm curious to know, where are you?
Mm-hmm.
Where are you coming from as far as, you know, the evolution of your fundamentalism and, mm-hmm, your PCA past, mm-hmm, and these kind of semi-evangelical circles?
Yeah.
Where are you today and how did you kind of come out of that?
Yeah. Big question.
Sorry.
No, it's definitely where we both knew this is where we're going to jump into. Good question. So for me, going back to kind of how I just kind of closed as far as being a firefighter and being exposed to so much suffering, I began to ask a lot of questions because I felt like my experience was not matching the theology I had been given. I felt like that the nice, neat answers that the church had given me to navigate suffering just wasn't cutting it anymore. And I began to ask, I think even coming out of that, the Calvinistic, well, you're elect, you're special. Let's just use that word. You're special. I was seeing a lot of people suffer who I thought they were special. You know, they were special people. They were people that loved Jesus. And I'm like, okay. So my experience isn't matching up with kind of what I was given, and life is hard. And what does the scripture have to say about that? I know for 4 years from the first shift on the rig to a very significant injury that happened in my life, it was cumulatively building up in me these questions and this curiosity and this, I'm just not so sure, but I was ignoring it because it was not at that time. Even though I was seeing it and a level of empathy that I had was processing some of it, I would go to church on Sunday and almost get I don't know if brainwashed is the word I would use, but maybe indoctrinated at some level out of it. You know, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Kind of reinvigorated. Yeah. Kind of like that internal revival.
Correct. Yep. You know, and it was just like, oh, yeah, yeah.
That's what they did. That's what they did to us when they took us to, we had a thing called Super WoW that we went to as youth.
Okay.
And it, every year, you know, you, once you're going back to school, all the kids that went are just on fire for Jesus.
Right.
And it's this,
yeah.
It's this, they, it's this reinforcement over the summer.
Yep.
And it fades. You see it fade, but I was the kid that it didn't fade for.
Right.
So anyway, yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah.
So when I fast forward from that first shift and a lot of the very traumatic things that I had experienced and seen, and then landing into 2013, I, being a mountain guy, being an outdoor guy, at the time was really spending a lot of time mountain biking. And we have very, very steep, fast trails here with the highest peaks in the entire range from Georgia to Maine. And I had a very violent mountain biking accident. So violent, in fact, that I broke my neck. My C6 or my C7 snapped. I was insanely fortunate that I didn't have any permanent spinal damage as far as my spinal cord at all. I was paralyzed momentarily for a bit when the accident first occurred. And the only thing residual that I have from that accident is I can't feel temperature on my right leg, which is kind of weird. But other than I can feel touch, I just can't feel temperature. But other than that, full recovery. But it was in that moment. So two things happened in 2013. The first was, even before that wreck, I was diagnosed with adult onset type 1 diabetes, which is normally what kids get. So rather than most diabetics, the majority of diabetics are type 2, which can be driven by lots of different factors. But the idea is your body's making insulin. It's just resistant to it. Type 1 is your beta cells in your pancreas are no longer making insulin. So you have to put synthetic insulin in to survive. It's just it's a lot higher maintenance form of diabetes. And I manage it in a very alternative way that's kept me super healthy. Whenever I go to the doctor and they take my blood, they're like, your blood work says you don't have it. But we know if you started eating differently and doing life differently, it would flare. So I'm real thankful that I was able to get under control real quick. And I'm always looking more alternative ways to do it. You know, my personality well enough now, I'm always skeptical of the masses and the status quo.
Yeah.
So found an alternative way through a brilliant endocrinologist out of New York to manage. And I remember thinking when that happened, I was like, this is a bummer, you know, but it was kind of like that. All the questions I was asking about suffering, I was like, well, this is kind of a significant suffering for myself. And I'm kind of feeling something kind of significant. But I just kind of attributed it. I mean, literally, man, you're gonna laugh. I just attributed it to God, you know, and it's pretty selfish to even say this. It's like, well, God gave me this. I'm so special. Like, I got this diabetes so that I can help other people with diabetes. He gave me this so that I can conquer it, you know, which, man, that's the opposite coin of prosperity gospel. I am so special that he's allowing me to suffer because I can, you know, he gave me this and
you can handle it.
And I was kind of in that mindset, sort of. Managing it, I got diagnosed in June, and then come October, so 4 months after, violent mountain biking crash, neck broke, like week in the hospital, full-on spinal surgery. Came out, was told, you may never ride a fire truck again, which felt devastating to me. And at that point, the gloves were off. I'm like, okay. My experience of watching other people suffering isn't matching the faith I've carried. And then my experience right now is completely different than the faith that I've carried at that point for, you know, 12, 13 years. And the gloves came off and it was a full on, this is what I really think. And I was coming from it from that. You could have prevented this. You caused that. I was pissed. I was very angry.
Was this internal or were you expressing this?
I was expressing it to other people. So it was definitely internal, but I was also expressing it to my wife, who's just this amazing person. And she was going through her own evolution that was different than mine. But she is just this amazing soul that can just carry. She's so empathetic and just can carry so much. And she just gave me the freedom just to let it loose. I didn't go in front of my church and stand up and say, this is, you know, I wasn't that public, but I was very honest in social settings. This is what I'm dealing with. This is what I'm struggling with. And for the first time, it gave me the permission. There were certain books that I was just afraid to read because my conservative evangelical community says, you know, those are no-no books. You shouldn't, you know, you don't read those kind of books. Those are dangerous books. Almost like, you know, don't be around gay people. You hang around gay people, you might
catch it.
Yeah. Ridiculous.
So what were the books?
My first dive is I dove into some Greg Boyd books. Boyd's a progressive evangelical pastor out of St. Paul, a personal friend of my father-in-law. So those are the first books. I got introduced in Open Theism, which was like, whoa, and then to even read, like, wait a minute, there's actually, and I was still an inerrancy guy at the time. I was like, whoa, there's actually decent scriptural arguments being made for this open theist position.
Yeah.
And then from there, I pushed into Thomas Merton. I pushed into Richard Rohr. I pushed into Pete Enns.
I wish that these are names that I had known whenever I had my crisis, because that would have been a something nice to approach for my fundamentalist brain.
Yes.
Would have been a better transition.
Yes. For me, it was a good slide. It felt like it was a slide rather than just a free fall. I love hearing you say that. That makes a lot of sense. I feel like if I didn't have those guys, it would have been a very different experience for me. And I would have been okay either way, you know? So I had these books I was digesting and working through, and my faith began to shift incredibly quickly from a place of, you know, previous eternal torment and election, and to the deep, benevolent universe, the love of God, to a universal sense of salvation and love and redemption. And it made sense, and it also felt like it was mirroring the experience I was having at that time as well. So I would say that was my deconstruction. That was the beginning of it. Erica, my wife, had already been through it before me, and which was just so wonderful too, because as I was going through it, she already had the small library of books just to hand to me. Like, I think you might find this interesting or read this. She was the one that brought me Boyd's book and said, hey, I think this may be helpful if you want to read it. Not an asshole, like, read this. You know, this is going to solve all your problems. Yeah. But if you want. And just with her patience and just beautiful spirit. So, I started digesting these things, and it brought me to these new spaces. Now, that being said, I use the word re-evangelical often. And what I mean by that is my ideology was changing, but my psychology wasn't changing. So I was changing the way I thought about things, but I was still kind of an asshole inside. Like, my deconstruction, I was very angry. And I think that's necessary and okay. I think that's part of the journey. Yeah. You need to go through that.
I was so bad. I was really, 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 really angry.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you went through some of my old stuff, you'd just be like, wow, who is this guy?
Yeah. And I've looked at some of your stuff on your website, I think when we first met, and I could see it, you know, I could see it and smell it, but it's beautiful at the same, you know, it's just part of the journey, and we got to go through it.
Yeah.
And, so I love that you understand where I'm coming from when I say that. And I have a lot of friends now that are in these deconstructives, they're entering into it, and they are pissed. Like, and I don't try to talk them out of their anger. I'm like,
no, you got to have,
let it fly.
I think
bro.
It's important.
Let it fly. And so that's where I was. I'm getting very angry. And that term re-evangelical, what I mean is, you know, my theology, my ideology was different. But just like I was still in a space of, but I'm right. Like, I was wrong before. Now I got this new way of thinking, and I am right about this new way of thinking. This is where I use the whole re-evangelical.
I'm the same way about everything.
Yeah, it's like you never really grew. You just changed your mind on the way things look, on the way that people believe something that really is just faith, you know? So spent a few years in those spaces and was learning a lot. Just felt so freeing to read the no-no books. Really just a lot of growth, and my anger began to soften. The word that a lot of folks would use is reconstruction. I don't know if I would use
that. I've seen that in some places.
I just found, and I've heard you say this recently, just co-hosting together, that you're just getting into softer spaces and more inclusive spaces. And that's definitely been my experience too. Even though I can still get chippy about certain things in my heart, I'm just way more gracious than I was 3-4 years ago when I was just so angry and so bitter. Of course, COVID was so weird. Right before COVID, for the first time, I'd been to church in a while. For the first time, I said, I'm gonna go to church. And I went to an Episcopal church here in our town. Just a beautiful community, lovely priest. She's wonderful. And I went to, they have it's just called the spoken word service. There's no music, which I really appreciated because I have a very tumultuous relationship with church music, which is a whole other.
I do too.
Whole other conversation for another episode or one day. But
I was explaining that I saw it yesterday.
Are you explaining what?
I was explaining that to a young guy yesterday who was having a worship service thing like at the local theater. Mm. They're like doing live music and stuff, and he needed my help with something, so I went to help him, and he invited me, and I was like, PTSD.
Totally. No. That's me. Oh, man. Oh, I get it. I mean,
you don't know.
No, I mean, this would anger half the world, but I hear tune or two from Hillsong, and I'm like, I mean, I gotta counter that with some Rage Against the Machine, bro. Like,
I gotta get away from
it out of my head. I need to get into some dark spaces here just to get that out.
Yeah,
even those dark spaces that I gotta get into feel lighter to me from the dark space than what I,
yes, 100%.
Yeah. So,
I'm so with you.
Oh man, so
I struggle with it,
big time. Same. So, when I heard that there was a service that had zero music, I'm like, that sounds cool, I'm in, I'll check it out. Walked into this 8 a.m. in the morning, and I'm a morning guy, so it was great. And I went alone. The sanctuary was I wouldn't say a tenth full, but maybe 50 people there at best. And kind of, I grew up in the evangelical Protestant world. I don't know this up and down and say things and when they bow, and I don't know any of this. But I'm just trying to keep up, and it'd probably been hilarious if somebody was actually watching me just kind of looking around to get my cues. But what I loved about the service is that rather than the service orbiting a person or a sermon, it orbited the Eucharist. Everything orbited communion. And this idea of let's reflect on, for me, a radical brown man that was killed by empire to show love to the world. And I'm like,
amen. Wow.
Okay, I can get on board with this. And
this was at what sort of congregation?
Episcopal. This was an Episcopal congregation.
Okay. I think I missed that. Okay.
So,
wow.
The Eucharist began, and the way that they practiced it in this service is you come to the front and the priest serves you. There was a gentleman that was sitting there. He was blind, and he had a German Shepherd seeing eye dog with him. He had a disability. And I was just real intrigued by the guy. He came in a little bit late with his dog and sat in his service dog. Well, because I was so I was literally watching cues from everybody. When we walked to the front to take the Eucharist, I was like the last person to walk up because I just wanted to make sure I didn't do something stupid, you know, like a ding dong in front of, you know, 50 people. Mm-hmm. So I'm watching them all take the Eucharist. Well, I'm standing there and I'm just really moved. And I feel this hand touch my shoulder. And I turn around and it's this blind man. And I don't know how blind he is, but obviously legally blind. And he just leaned in and all he said was, "Welcome to our table, brother." That was it.
Oh,
and I lost it.
Fine.
I just lost it and participated, went back the next week. Erica came back with me soon after that. This was literally right before COVID really hit. We went to, what did we go to? We went to Ash Wednesday. Am I saying that right? Yeah. Went to Ash Wednesday service right before Easter. I had to work Easter weekend, so I couldn't go to that. COVID hit. And that was it. And we just weren't connected to the congregation anymore because of COVID, but we would jump in and watch online services. They were very protective of their congregation, unlike a lot of churches that were like, you know, screw masks and screw this and let's all get in here and, you know, pass a virus, you know, amongst one another. God will protect us. I heard that a lot. You know, God will protect us. Of course, they all ended up sick or some on respirators. So that was, for me, a place where I think I began to, if reconstruct is the word to use, I began to soften. And I was like, okay, I just experienced such a beautiful image of grace with these people. And I need to have that for myself and have that for my friends and community that are in that place. Richard Rohr, who I referenced earlier, he talks about three boxes. There's three boxes of growth, and one is construction, then deconstruction, and then reconstruction. And he said that's just a necessary order to be a healthy person. And
agree.
And when we're young, we're given that, which I was given so well from my parents, a box. It was that construction that I was in. Then suffering in my life, observing the suffering of others and going through my own, shattered that box. I did the deconstruction thing. I, you know, graduated really quick to the second box and sat in that box for a while and got to a point where I was like, this is a dark box. I needed it. This is important. This is part of the journey, but I don't want to live here long term. I need something much more sustainable. And that service in that Episcopal church was a turning point to start getting out. And that being said, I'll be honest, right where I'm at, I feel like I jump back and forth between that second and third box all the time, depending on how resourced I am, how rested, how well fed, just, you know, how I'm doing, how my family's doing.
Yeah.
So that's where I... At that point, that was kind of getting me to these much healthier spaces. And then in 2001, Erica was diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. And that was a journey that none of us were expecting, particularly this young. I had just turned 40. She's a year older than me. So she was 41 or 40, well, early 40s. And I am still, Matt, unpacking that whole experience, still living. We're still in it. Every scan, we're still in it. Every time she gets scanned.
Yeah.
And I have evolved at this point where I'm probably more agnostic than ever. A lot of people, I guess they... And that's a little aside, we had the craziest thing said to us when she was going through her cancer treatments from well-meaning people. And I share this on your podcast. Hopefully this will be helpful for someone listening. I had a good friend who lost his mom really early, really young. And he told me, he was like, dude, he said, you wouldn't believe the bullshit people told us when my mom died. It was so awful. But where we got to is what they're trying to say to us, but they're not saying it well, is we love you. We love you. And we're here. They just say it in these horrible ways that's very warped and damaging. And we just have to let that go by us and say, what they need to do is just sit here with us, be quiet with us, grieve with us. That's what we need. And so they open their mouths and they say stupid shit. But
yeah, the silence is difficult.
It is. It's very difficult. But,
yeah.
But so necessary.
You know, in Judaism, yes. Shiva, it's,
yeah.
I think that's the thing we should bring into the rest of the culture.
Precisely.
I think it's just having a presence is sometimes all you need.
So true.
And that's something. And you don't have to talk.
And it's so much more effective, but I don't use the word effective. It's just so much more meaningful. I've learned so similar with the Shiva. I do that. So if I have a friend that's whatever it may be, a cancer diagnosis, I had a buddy in the fire department, very young, got a cancer diagnosis, and I would drive an hour. He'd live deep in the mountains. And I would just drive to his bedside and sit there. That was it. I would just sit with Will and we would maybe talk for 10 minutes. And then I would just sit there for 30 and hold his hand. And sometimes he would cry and I'd cry with him. And the last time I saw him, I spent the last 15 minutes in the bed with him. I mean, he's just frail little guy. At the time, he probably weighed 60 pounds. And I just laid in bed with him, got him under covers, and we just sat there. Didn't say a word. And we would laugh and weep. And yeah, there's just real power in that. Real power. So I'm with you, brother.
I do a lot of that in the context of people grieving God.
So good.
And it's an important thing, I think. I think it's a missing aspect. When you go through like the deconstruction process and you come out the other end without belief, I don't think people will really give you space for the grief that is inevitable. I don't see that addressed very often. I see people talk about the trauma. I see people talk about, you know, rage learning and trying to understand all the things they didn't understand before and like really read every book you can find. I see a lot of that, but I don't see a lot talked about with grief. And that's what I've kind of always focused on is the grief side of it. Because I was grieved. It still does. It still is kind of the subject of most of my grief.
What a ministry too for you to recognize that and practice that.
It's meaningful work to me. It's very meaningful. And it's hard to describe too. Like, what does that entail? A lot of times it's just talking or shutting up.
That's right.
One of the two.
Learning that balance. And I think for me, realizing that I just need to shut up 90% of the time and ask questions more when I open my mouth, you know, questions.
Yeah. I do a lot of those dialogues with people, and it sometimes for years, and it does make a difference. I think it makes a difference for me too. I guess
it's absolutely that's the beauty of it. I think.
Yeah. I think that's why I have such an understanding of this process is because I've just heard people talk about like you were talking about kids being so inconvenient, saying the things that you're not supposed to say. Like a lot of people have said those things to me for the very first time. Like the very first time you say out loud that you don't believe in God is terrifying.
Yes.
it's immense. And that's an honor to hear from people. Anyway, I'm getting emotional.
And you should. It's a death. And deaths are emotional things that should be, it's a sacred moment. It's just a sacred moment, whether it's an ideological death, a religious death, physical death, relational death. It's a profound moment. So, man, I love that. So good. gosh, where were we?
Well, you're more agnostic than ever.
Yeah. So going on that journey with Erica, and just for the listener, she's doing incredibly well. And this is, something I think is really important to say too. We had a lot of people praying for us. We were praying the best we knew how. But at the, you know, I use the phrase, get in the balcony, like in the balcony view, getting in the balcony and looking down the balcony view. So wonderful that Erica had such a, I mean, she had a complete response to chemotherapy. Amazing. We found out even after that, it was like, yeah, she didn't have a complete response. It was a palliative path until she passed, which we didn't understand that at the time. It's like, oh my gosh. Like we just thought it was just going to be, chemotherapy, surgery, we carry on. They're like, no, if she didn't have a complete response, we weren't going to be doing anything major to her. She had a complete response, and then it was the surgeries and the recovery and all that. So it's been a long journey, and we couldn't be more grateful. That said, I know so many people, good people, that prayed the exact same prayers we prayed, that wanted the exact same things from the goodness of their heart, and they didn't get it, Matt. Like, they passed.
Yeah.
So for me, I have to be honest and say, was it divine intervention? And if it was, why did we get it and they didn't? Because I don't believe God plays favorites. I don't do that bullshit anymore. Or is it just really good medicine? And the fact that Erica is in excellent shape and takes such good care of herself. And I mean, she did so many alternative things with the chemotherapy, you know, dove into turkey tail mushrooms and got such good rest. And we did so many things psychologically to give her things to look forward to in the future. Did we just scientifically just do it in a way that worked? And my bet is that's what we did.
Yeah, I think
that's
exactly.
That's the spot I'm in, and that's where I am. And I think that has moved us even down from at least me a slope of, you know, it's great religion, just or is healthy spirituality, just great psychology, and that's it.
Yeah,
and I'm not afraid of a dirt nap.
I don't know.
You know, I'm not afraid of it not being real. But I also have said this, and I do believe this. If I get on my deathbed and I'm told it's not literally true, my answer would be, I'm not surprised. But still is true. It may not have literally been true.
Yeah.
But at some measure, it did give me an incredibly, it wasn't perfect, but a following Jesus was a very incredibly healthy context for me to live in. And I would do some things different, but I'd follow him again. You know, I've had to do it all over again. So it may not be literally true, but it doesn't mean that it can't still be true. And pressing into, particularly for me recently, I've gotten real into the Tao Te Ching and moving into Eastern texts. And I'm just seeing the parallels, what I would say in, you know, mystic Christianity, not the evangelical, you know, politician we won't speak of, not that whole weird movement, the Calvinist movement, but Jesus at Jesus's core, which I know you know what I mean when I say that, the core of this radical, brilliant teacher. Man, these guys are all saying the same shit. And I love it. And it's really helpful. And
yeah.
Go ahead. I feel like you want to interject.
I'm kind of in the same place. You know, I read the Quran when I was like 13 or 14, and I read the Bible incessantly from that time on until I was probably 20. And when I read the Quran, I was like, wow, this doesn't feel that different. And if I'm really honest, the other one's more violent.
Right.
Yeah. If I'm really honest, this guy sounds a little better. Mm-hmm. Just a little. Yep. Not perfect. Sounds a little better. and that's so true with so many different religious texts that I would kind of say very similar to what you're saying. Today, I would say, I think the Bible and I think holy texts are the best effort we can do at the time that we're doing it to explain the world through the lenses that we have, through all of our biases, all of our bullshit. It is the good, the bad, and the ugly of humanity, sometimes misattributed as divine.
Yes.
But that story, that human story, is the divine thing to me. And that is why the Bible is such a valuable book, because it is telling a human story.
It is.
And that is, and it's a universal human story that everyone can get something out of.
It's part of the human experience. And to the credit of the Jewish people, to collect those writings, to put them in a library, and to just show the world, these are our failures. These are our successes.
True.
Thank you. Like, thank you for doing that. And for me, the text to me is also an evolution. And I said this recently in the podcast, you know, in Pastoral No Answers. For me, it's a book of the evolution of human consciousness and their understanding of God. And so much stuff gets attributed to God in the Old Testament. You know, I said my hermeneutics, Jesus, when I'm in these places of faith, my hermeneutics, Jesus, if it doesn't, and that takes a measure of faith. If it doesn't align with the person of Jesus, then I don't think whatever was written in the Old Testament is really God. I think, you know, Abraham came from a culture where they sacrificed kids all the time. Like, that was normal.
Yeah.
So of course it would be written, God told us to sacrifice Isaac. And then we had this giant step forward where God intervenes and goes, I don't think you need to do that anymore. Like, stop, please. Please stop. But there's confusion as to, well, who was the voice of God, who wasn't. Anyway, for me, I don't necessarily need for it to be literally true or not. And I know that that's a gray area that a lot of people struggle with. It's just where I've landed. And there are days where I do feel faithful. And there are days where I feel super agnostic. And that is just me. And who knows where my journey will go on from here, if I'll get more agnostic to a place of atheism, or if I'll become more deeply connected into faith and a belief in the divine. But what I know right here and right now is that we are in a world that is on fire, that is what I would define as hell, hellacious. And we have great teachers, Jesus being one of them, that is pointing to an alternative way to live, to make things better for the least of these, for the poor, for the marginalized, for the minorities. And that's what I want to be about. And if I get on the other side and it's literally true, great. And if I get on my deathbed and it's not, I still feel like I participated in a great work and I'm grateful. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's nice. Beautiful, Hayne.
Well, I think the same's true of you.
Well, thank you. Yeah. The way I approach the whole thing has changed so considerably now that my reverence for the Bible and for the person of Jesus feels much deeper than it ever did, because I see it for what I think it really is, for this human work, this human attempt to do what is really and truly beyond us, to understand something so big as this, that what we're in. And, you know, it explains why we commit atrocities. It explains why we stop committing atrocities. It explains so many things about our evolution. And all of these books do, all of these texts do that in some way. Yes. That it's hard not to see this beautiful humanity in it.
Precisely. I want to ask you a question, and it was in my mind when we were just kind of talking earlier before we got kind of to my story. And I think I heard you correctly, but it kind of glitched out, so I want to make sure. But I feel like you mentioned, you used the phrase Christian agnosticism, which I used earlier. And that was intriguing to you? That was something to you that kind of tickled your imagination a bit? Is that what you were saying?
I'm really curious. I've kind of been in that realm for some time, for a long time, really. But I kind of detached myself from the from the Christian belief so much. And I would say today I practice a Christianity as I understand it. And I don't believe that that has any bearing on what I believe about God.
That's beautiful.
And I don't think that Jesus was really, I think Jesus was talking about God in the same sense that the Bible is talking about God. Yeah. And it is this guy trying to connect to things that are beyond him. I see the way that we are intended to approach humanity as if I treat you as if you are God. And if I treat the least of these as if they are God, then I am prioritizing God's creation appropriately. And that is more important than what I believe about God. And so what I do, it's the practice.
Preach. I love it. I mean, out of the words of Jesus himself, when you've done it to the least of these, you've done it to me.
Yeah.
He placed himself in that space.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and we're in a world now that, like you said, is on fire. There are no less than 4 genocides happening right now on our planet. People are being slaughtered left and right, largely by the hand of our own government, or by the weapons we produce and our policies.
Directly or indirectly,
So there's this, there's also this survivor's guilt for being so safe and comfortable and being able to talk with a friend on a, from a couple hundred miles away about God in our lives. And I think a lot of that is reflected in the Jesus I understand, and how we approach that is reflected in that man.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah. Well, I will let you, if you have any closing words or if you want to plug your socials or anything like that. Have you written a book yet?
I haven't, but I do have a working title. I don't consider myself to be a great writer, but I've been encouraged by some folks to do it. But because of what I do for a living and just other different things I've gleaned over time, my working title is "Don't Be a Dick: Leadership Lessons I've Learned from Firehouse to Fatherhood." Thanks, man.
That would, if it didn't have the word dick in there, you could sell that at every Christian bookstore. So you might have to come up with a Christianese version.
I'm definitely not looking for any Christian audience here, but I actually have an outline for it. I don't know when it's going to start getting fully written.
But nice.
I've been plugging away at it for, at this point, when I say plugging, loosely plugging. For a couple of years now, just got a document that I'm just adding things to and things I hear there. And that's been one book idea. And the second one was my son, who's actually sitting here. I don't even know if he's looking at me. Yeah, he sees me. He turned 13 last May. So he's about to turn 14 in a couple of weeks. And I took him, one of the things I told him is I said, when you turn 13, let's go on a big trip, just the two of us. So one of the cool things that we got to do is we took off to the Outer Banks, same state. We're in North Carolina, but that's a really long state horizontally on the map. So it's an 8-hour drive for us to get from Asheville to Hatteras. So we took this really cool long journey together. We love the Outer Banks, how wild it is, and just the fishing off the chain. Had this amazing 4 or 5 days together fishing and just building huge fires on the beach and just having a blast. But each night, before we left, I asked a group of men who knew him, would you please write him a letter on what it means to become a healthy person, a healthy man? And they did. It was beautiful.
Wow.
And each night I'd give him a couple of letters and he would read them. But the last letter he got was a letter from me. And I've been encouraged by some family members that have seen it, like, oh man, you should take that letter and kind of dissect it down into a book maybe one day. So we'll see. But those are some ideas I have. As far as socials, the only thing I do is Instagram.
Yeah.
So I'm not a big social media person. And a lot of that I think was very intentional. I was younger because I knew myself well enough to know I wouldn't handle it well. And I'm at a place now where I'm middle-aged and I just I don't know if I give a shit anymore. So,
yeah, I wouldn't have any of it if I didn't have a business, because you really can't.
Spot on. I get it. It makes total sense.
But I wish I could divorce myself from it.
I do the Instagram thing. If people want to find me, my handle is Vado Griff, Vado, V-A-D-O-G-R-I-S. G-R-I-F-F, maybe? Well, there's one F or two Fs, and then Vado. Yeah.
I'll link to it. I'll make sure.
Which all that is too. Is Latin for Vado's go in Latin. So it's Latin for go, Griff, go, because we are always on the move. We're always traveling and getting out and camping and trying to have adventures with friends and family. And so that's just the name of the handle. So I don't post a lot, but feel free to jump in if anybody wants to check it out. And that's all I got.
Yeah, I look forward to the book.
Oh, thank
the books. I think that would be great. I think you tell a good story. You're good to listen to. So I imagine you can write just as well. If you just use the same voice you're using, you'll get
I'm a stream of conscious writer.
Writing is hard. I struggle. Yeah, I am too. I it's a struggle for me to actually get it all out there and to get the train to slow down enough to actually get the thought on paper. It's a real struggle, but I think you'd be an interesting read.
That. Buddies of mine who are artists, be it musicians, painters, even filmmakers, they just say, just get stuff down. It doesn't have to be polished or clean. Just vomit it out.
Yeah.
Because once you get it visually on paper, then you can start to organize it, you know, and I just need to do that.
Sometimes I get that vomit out and give it to someone else and then say, help me here. What does this make any sense at all? Or is it just my delusional brain trying to make sense of a concept?
Yep.
I will leave on this note. The last guest of the podcast, Jamin Collier, just released a new book. So I want to plug that real quick. Let me open. It's incredibly good. And it's got the longest name. It's called If I'm Really Honest, The Transparent Thought Life of a Reluctant Deconstructionist. Very good book. So far, I've greatly enjoyed it. So I hope that you'll, if you're listening, go check it out and listen to his story as well. He actually released the book after that. So he didn't get to plug it at the time, but I want to plug it now. I think it's a really good piece of work, and it describes the process of deconstruction extremely well, and is talking to the church and the people he cares about in a way that is worth listening to. But I will leave you guys with that. Hayne, thank you so much. I greatly enjoyed this.
Thank you for just letting me tell my story and give me that space. And I love you. And I'll see you next week. Or is it next week? I'll see you soon. I know that.
Sometime. Yeah. We'll be hosting or interviewing John Pavlovic. Is that,
I think that's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll have to confirm with him, but, on the Pastor with No Answers podcast, you know, we questions.
Do. We have questions and concerns.
Yeah, for real. So look forward to that. Hopefully this will be published before that.
Sounds great.
Hayne, thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Matt. Thank you so much.